Chapter 62. See by your letter that they are much better now, or nearly well. When we visited you a month ago, it seemed to us that your Keokuk weather was pretty hot. John and Clara sat up in bed at Mrs. McElroy's and cried about it, and so did I. But I judge by your letter that it has cooled down now, so that a person is comparatively comfortable with his skin off. Well, it did need cooling. I remember that I burned a hole in my shirt, there, with some ice cream that fell on it. And Miss Jenkins told me they never used a stove, but cooked their meals on a marble-topped table in the drawing room, just with the natural heat. If anybody else had told me, I would not have believed it. I was told by the Bishop of Keokuk that he did not allow crying at funerals, because it scalded the furniture. If Miss Jenkins had told me that, I would have believed it. This reminds me that you speak of Dr. Jenkins and his family as if they were strangers to me. Indeed they are not. Don't you suppose I remember gratefully how tender the doctor was with John when she hurt her arm, and how quickly he got the pain out of the hurt, whereas I supposed it was going to last at least an hour? No, I don't forget some things as easily as I do others. Yes, it was pretty hot weather. Now here, when a person is going to die, he is always in a sweat about where he is going to. But in Keokuk of course they don't care, because they are fixed for everything. It has set me reflecting, it has taught me a lesson. By and by, when my health fails, I am going to put all my affairs in order, and bid goodbye to my friends here, and kill all the people I don't like, and go out to Keokuk, and prepare for death. They are all well in this family, and we all send love. Affably, your son Sam. The ways of city officials and corporations are often past understanding, and Mark Twain sometimes found it necessary to write picturesque letters of protest. The following to a Hartford Lighting Company is a fair example of these documents. To a Gas and Electric Lighting Company, in Hartford. Gentlemen, there are but two places in our whole street where lights could be of any value, by any accident, and you have measured and appointed your intervals so ingeniously as to leave each of those places in the center of a couple of hundred yards of solid darkness. When I noticed that you were setting one of your lights in such a way that I could almost see how to get into my gate at night, I suspected that it was a piece of carelessness on the part of the workman, and would be corrected as soon as you should go around inspecting and find it out. My judgment was right. It is always right when you act concerned. For 15 years, in spite of my prayers and tears, you persistently kept a gas lamp exactly halfway between my gates, so that I couldn't find either of them after dark, and then furnished such execrable gas that I had to hang a danger signal on the lamppost to keep teams from running into it nights. Now I suppose your present idea is to leave us a little more in the dark. Don't mind us out our way. We possess but one vote apiece, and no rights which you are in any way bound to respect. Please take your electric light, and go to, but never mind, it is not for me to suggest. You will probably find the way, and any way you can reasonably count on divine assistance, if you lose your bearings. S. 50. Clemens. Text editor's note. Twain wrote another note to Hartford Gas and Electric, which he may not have mailed, and which Payne does not include in these volumes. Entleman. Someday you are going to move me almost to the point of irritation with your goddamn chuckle-headed fashion of turning off your goddamned gas without giving notice to your goddamned parishioners, and you did it again last night, D. W.W. Frequently Clemens did not send letters of this sort after they were written. Sometimes he realized the uselessness of such protest, sometimes the mere writing of them had furnished the necessary relief, and he put the letter away or into the wastebasket and wrote something more temperate or nothing at all. A few such letters here follow. Clemens was all the time receiving application from people who wished him to recommend one article or another. Books, plays, tobacco, and whatnot. They were generally persistent people, unable to accept a polite or kindly denial. Once he set down some remarks on this particular phase of correspondence. He wrote, "I, no doubt Mr. Edison has been offered a large interest in many an electrical project, for the use of his name to float it with Al. And no doubt all men who have achieved for their names, in any line of activity whatever, a sure market value, have been familiar with this sort of solicitation. Reputation is a hallmark. It can remove doubt from pure silver, and it can also make the plated article pass for pure. And so, people without a hallmark of their own, are always trying to get the loan of somebody else's. As a rule, that kind of a person, sees only one side of the case. He sees that his invention or his painting, or his book is apparently a trifle better than you yourself can do, therefore why shouldn't you be willing to put your hallmark on it? You will be giving the purchaser his full money's worth. So who is hurt, and where is the harm? Besides, are you not helping a struggling fellow craftsman, and is it not your duty to do that? That side is plenty clear enough to him, but he can't and won't see the other side, to wit, that you are a rascal, if you put your hallmark upon a thing which you did not produce yourself, howsoever good it may be. How simple that is. And yet there are not two applicants in 100 who can be made to see it. When one receives an application of this sort, his first emotion is an indignant sense of insult. His first deed is the penning of a sharp answer. He blames nobody but that other person. That person is a very base being. He must be. He would degrade himself for money, otherwise it would not occur to him that he would do such a thing. But all the same, that application has done its work, and taken you down in your own estimation. You recognize that everybody hasn't as high an opinion of you as you have of yourself. And in spite of you there ensues an interval during which you are not, in your own estimation, as fine a bird as you were before. However, being old and experienced, you do not mail your sharp letter, but leave it lying a day. That saves you. For by that time you have begun to reflect that you are a person who deals in exaggerations, and exaggerations are lies. You meant yours to be playful, and thought you made them unmistakably so. But you couldn't make them playfulnesses to a man who has no sense of the playful, and can see nothing but the serious side of things. You rattle on quite playfully, and with measureless extravagance, about how you wept at the tomb of Adam. And all in good time you find to your astonishment, that no end of people took you at your word and believed you. And presently they find out, that you were not in earnest. They have been deceived. Therefore, as they argue and there is a sort of argument in it, you are a deceiver. If you will deceive in one way, why shouldn't you in another? So they apply for the use of your trademark. You are amazed and affronted. You retort that you are not that kind of person. Then they are amazed and affronted. And wonder since when? By this time you have got your bearings. You realize that perhaps there is a little blame on both sides. You are in the right frame now. So you write a letter void of offense, declining. You mail this one. You pigeonhole the other. That is, being old and experienced, you do, but early in your career, you don't. You mail the first one. 2. An enthusiast who had a new system of musical notation, wrote to me, and suggested that a magazine article from me, contrasting the absurdities of the old system with the simplicities of his new one, would be sure to make a housing hit. He shouted and shouted over the marvels wrought by his system, and quoted the handsome compliments which had been paid it by famous musical people. But he forgot to tell me what his notation was like, or what its simplicities consisted in. So I could not have written the article, if I had wanted to, which I didn't, because I hate strangers with axes to grind. I wrote him a courteous note explaining how busy I was. I always explain how busy I am, and casually drooped this remark. I judge the XX notation to be a rational mode of representing music, in place of the prevailing fashion, which was the invention of an idiot. Next mail he asked permission to print that meaningless remark. I answered, no, courteously, but still, no, explaining that I could not afford to be placed in the attitude of trying to influence people with a mere worthless guess. What a scorcher I got, next mail. Such irony. Such sarcasm, such caustic praise of my super honorable loyalty to the public. And withal, such compassion for my stupidity too, in not being able to understand my own language. I cannot remember the words of this letter broadside, but there was about a page used up in turning this idea round and exposing it in different lights. Unmailed answer. Dear sir, what is the trouble with you? If it is your viscera, you cannot have them taken out and reorganized a moment too soon. I mean, if they are inside. But if you are composed of them, that is another matter. Is it your brain? But it could not be your brain. Possibly it is your skull. You want to look out for that. Some people, when they get an idea, it pries the structure apart. Your system of notation has got in there, and couldn't find room, without a doubt, that is what the trouble is. Your skull was not made to put ideas in, it was made to throw potatoes at. Yours truly. Mailed answer. Dear sir, come, come, take a walk, you disturb the children. Yours truly. There was a day, now happily nearly over, when certain newspapers made a practice of inviting men distinguished in any walk of life, to give their time and effort without charge, to express themselves on some subject of the day, or perhaps they were asked to send their favorite passages in prose or verse, with the reasons why. Such symposiums were eachers, that cost the newspapers only the writing of a number of letters, stationery, and postage. To one such invitation Mark Twain wrote two replies. They follow herewith. Unmailed answer. Dear sir, I have received your proposition which you have imitated from a pauper London periodical which had previously imitated the idea of this sort of mendicancy from 7th-rate American journalism, where it originated as a variation of the inexpensive interview. Why do you buy Associated Press dispatches? To make your paper the more saleable, you answer. But why don't you try to beg them? Why do you discriminate? I can sell my stuff. Why should I give it to you? Why don't you ask me for a shirt? What is the difference between asking me for the worth of a shirt and asking me for the shirt itself? Perhaps you didn't know you were begging. I would not use that argument. It makes the user a fool. The passage of poetry or prose, if you will, which has taken deepest root in my thought, and which I oftenest return to, and dwell upon with keenest no matter what, is this. That the proper place for journalists who solicit literary charity is on the street corner with their hats in their hands. Mailed answer. Dear sir, your favor of recent date is received, but I am obliged by press of work to decline. The manager of a traveling theatrical company wrote that he had taken the liberty of dramatizing Tom Sawyer, and would like also the use of the author's name, the idea being to convey to the public that it was a Mark Twain play. In return for this slight favor, the manager sent an invitation for Mark Twain to come and see the play, to be present on the opening night, as it were, at his, the manager's, expense. He added that, if the play should be a go in the cities, there might be some arrangement of profits. Apparently these inducements did not appeal to Mark Twain. The long unmailed reply is the more interesting, but probably the briefer one that follows it was quite as effective. Unmailed answer. Hartford, September 8, 87. Dear sir, and so it has got around to you, at last, and you also have taken the liberty. You are no 1365. When 1364 sweeter and better people, including the author, have tried to dramatize Tom Sawyer, and did not arrive, what sort of show do you suppose you stand? That is a book, dear sir, which cannot be dramatized. One might as well try to dramatize any other hymn. Tom Sawyer is simply a hymn, put into prose form to give it a worldly air. Why the pale doubt that flitteth dim and nebulous athwart the forecastle of your third sentence? Have no fears. Your piece will be a go. It will go out the back door on the first night. They've all done it to 1364. So will 1365. Not one of us ever thought of the simple device of half-soling himself with a stove lid. Ah, what suffering a little hindsight would have saved us. Treasure this hint. How kind of you to invite me to the funeral. Go to. I have attended 1,000 of them. I have seen Tom Sawyer's remains in all the different kinds of dramatic shrouds there are. You cannot start anything fresh. Are you serious when you propose to pay my expense if that is the Susquehannian way of spelling it? And can you be aware that I charge $100 a mile when I travel for pleasure? Do you realize that it is 432 miles to Susquehanna? Would it be handy for you to send me the $43.201st so I could be counting it as I come along? Because railroading is pretty dreary to a sensitive nature when there's nothing sorted to bucket for Zietvertrieb. Now as I understand it, dear and magnanimous 1365, you are going to recreate Tom Sawyer dramatically, and then do me the compliment to put me in the bills as father of this shady offspring. Sir, do you know that this kind of a compliment has destroyed people before now? Listen. 24 years ago, I was strangely handsome. The remains of it are still visible through the rifts of time. I was so handsome that human activity ceased, as if spellbound when I came in view, and even inanimate things stopped to look like locomotives, and district messenger boys and so on. In San Francisco, in the rainy season I was often mistaken for fair weather. Upon one occasion I was traveling in the Sonora region, and stopped for an hour's nooning, to rest my horse and myself. All the town came out to look. The tribes of Indians gathered to look. A Paiute squaw named her baby for me, a voluntary compliment which pleased me greatly. Other attentions were paid me. Last of all arrived the president and faculty of Sonora University, and offered me the post of professor of moral culture and the dogmatic humanities, which I accepted gratefully, and entered at once upon my duties. But my name had pleased the Indians, and in the deadly kindness of their hearts they went on naming their babies after me. I tried to stop it, but the Indians could not understand why I should object to so manifest a compliment. The thing grew, and spread, and became exceedingly embarrassing. The university stood it a couple of years, but then for the sake of the college they felt obliged to call a halt, although I had the sympathy of the whole faculty. The president himself said to me, "I am as sorry as I can be for you, and would still hold out if there were any hope ahead. But you see how it is. There are 132 of them already, and 14 precincts to hear from. The circumstance has brought your name into most wide and Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.